November 1945, a nondescript movie theater. Julius Rosenberg stepped into the dim screening room and quickly looked around. The movie was already playing, but he didn't mind. He wasn't there for a show. At the back of the theater, Julius made his way up a narrow staircase to the balcony. He watched the doors for a few seconds to make sure nobody had followed him. When he was satisfied he was alone, Julius walked the length of the balcony and stopped at a small alcove. He had been here many times before. This small hole in the back of the theater was his official drop zone. Whenever he wanted to contact a KGB agent, he left a message here. But today was different. When Julius reached into the alcove, he felt a message. He pulled it out. But it wasn't from Russia. It was one of his own. He had left this message 2 weeks ago, but it was still here. Why was it still here? The crowd laughed at the movie below him, blissful of the crisis going on overhead. This was bad, very bad. If his handler hadn't come to pick up his message, Julius didn't know what that meant. Was he compromised? How much time did he have? This is Espionage, the new Parcast original exploring the missions behind the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. I'm your host, Carter Roy. Throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. You can listen to all of Parcast shows on Spotify or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. New episodes come out every Friday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. This is our second and final episode on two of the world's most infamous atomic spies, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. In 1945, 27-year-old Julius Rosenberg and his 30-year-old wife Ethel orchestrated a top-secret operation to steal confidential information about the atomic bomb from right under the nose of the FBI. They delivered this information to Soviet intelligence and aided in the development of Russia's own nuclear bomb. Last week, we explored how these two American communists turned from activists into some of the most infamous spies in history. We also explored the beginning of their atomic bomb mission, how they received orders from the Soviet Union, and how espionage transformed their lives. This week, we'll follow the Rosenbergs to the end of their mission. We'll discover the consequences of their espionage and the devastation that followed. November 22nd, 1945. Anatoly Gorsky was sweating from the run over to Elizabeth Bentley's apartment. Since November 1944, he had been Elizabeth's handler. In this role, he was in charge of making sure any American intelligence she stole made it back to the Soviet Union. But today, he had news for her. He had just received a message from Soviet intelligence. An agent had turned. The so-called fellow countryman was in the FBI right now, drafting up a 107-page document with names of active Soviet spies. Once the FBI was aware of these names, it would be a manhunt. If Elizabeth's name was on the list, or if his name was on the list, the FBI would be close behind him. Anatoly shuddered at the thought as he continued to knock. But Elizabeth wasn't coming to the door. This wasn't like her. Had the FBI found her? Was she being questioned or tortured? If she would just open her damn door. Anatoly had had enough. He quickly picked the lock and stepped into the room. In a stern whisper, he called Elizabeth's name. She didn't respond. Anatoly worked his way deeper and deeper into the room. The FBI had been here. The thought was rising in his chest like a knot. They had taken her. Anatoly sat for a moment, collecting his thoughts. he had to tell Moscow Center. Maybe they would have time to save her. As the information about Elizabeth's disappearance made it back to the Soviet Union, 27-year-old Julius and 30-year-old Ethel Rosenberg were completely ignorant of the danger. They sat in the confines of their Lower East Side apartment, just miles from Elizabeth Bentley's former home. The only thing they were worried about was making contact with the Soviet Union. Over the last year, they had struggled to make any sort of communication with Soviet intelligence. Communication had diminished right after the Rosenbergs had delivered secrets of the American atomic bomb to the Soviet Union. Ethel and Julia shared a dark look across their dining room table. It was hard to live in a constant state of fear. Ethel stooped to pick up their 2-year-old son, Michael. He was probably hungry again. Julius watched his family across the room, trying his best to keep his nerves in check. He didn't like being left out of the loop. As a spy for the Soviet Union operating in the U.S., the average day was usually radio silence. No news was good news. But Julius couldn't shake the fear that something was different this time. The Soviet Union had never taken this long to respond before. He was a key member of their XY line, the specialized group of spies in charge of stealing industrial and technical secrets from the United States. He was very valuable to them. Why weren't they contacting him now? On December 12, 1945, Julius and Ethel finally heard from an old Soviet friend, Alexander Feklasov. As you may recall, Feklasov became Julius's second handler in April 1943. Feklasov helped bring the Rosenberg network into its golden age. While working together, he helped the Rosenbergs steal the complete design manual for the first U.S. jet fighter, the P-80 Shooting Star. Now, he was back to bring the Rosenbergs news. On December 12th, Feklasov used a drop zone to inform Julius that he wanted to meet in person on December 15th to discuss the defected agent that Anatoly was looking for. According to Spy, the rise and fall of the KGB in America, a government finds a turned agent by one of two ways. One, another agent knows who defected and can report on them. In this best-case scenario, the identity of the traitor is simply reported, and Soviet intelligence takes immediate defensive measures. Namely, they cut all ties with the defected agent and destroy any evidence connecting that agent to other Soviet spies. This ultimately protects as many spies as possible. At least, that's the easy way. More commonly, it goes the second way. No one reports, so the government has to check in with all of their major handlers. The handlers then check in with their agents currently working in the field, as Anatoly had done with Elizabeth. Then the handlers report back on what they find. Well, as you can imagine, this takes time. In a world devoid of instant messages, agents had to prove they were still loyal by delivering messages in drop zones or meeting with their handlers in person. A drop zone, as mentioned in the beginning of this episode, is a covert location used for information transfer. Rather than having two agents meet in the same place at the same time, one agent will leave information at the zone and the next agent will collect that information. These zones can be anything from a mailbox to a lighthouse to a loose brick in a wall. For Julius and Ethel, their drop zone was usually a movie theater in Long Island. Although we can't be sure exactly which theater was their drop zone, most experts believe it was the Colony Theater. Now the Broadway Theater at 1681 Broadway and 53rd, New York. This theater was mentioned several times in official KGB transmissions to Julius and Ethel. At the time, it was an Art Deco masterpiece equipped with an organ, 1,761 seats, and many convenient alcoves. It was with one of these alcoves that Feklasov arranged his secret meeting with the Rosenbergs. On December 15th, Feklasov stopped outside a small drugstore on the Lower East Side. There was not much to the place. By all accounts, it was just another hole in the wall. He stepped into the shop as casually as possible and did a loop around the store. About halfway around, he saw a young woman on the far side buying cotton balls. He had seen her picture before on a case file. It was Ethel. They made eye contact, and Ethel left the store. This simple act told Feklasov that the Rosenbergs were ready to meet with him. Following this confirmation, Feklasov bought a loaf of bread and two bottles of milk. This was according to plan. He would use these props as an excuse to walk with Ethel. If anyone asked why they were together, Feklasov would say that he was helping Ethel carry her groceries home. When they arrived at Ethel's apartment, Feklasov followed her inside and immediately brought the bread and milk to the kitchen. Waiting for him was Julius. Julius was glad to see him, but Feklasov was cautious. He asked Julius if he knew any of Jacob Golo's friends. Julius was taken aback. As you may recall, Jacob Golos had been Julius's first contact as a spy. In fact, Golos had helped Julius earn his codename Antenna. Through this, Julius and Golos grew close, at least until Golos' death in 1943. But Feklasov wasn't done. He asked Julius if he knew any women in Golos' life. The truth was beginning to descend on Julius. Feklasov knew which agent had defected, and that agent was very close to Golos, and by association, close to Julius. Julius told Feklasov that whenever he wanted to make contact with Golos, he would call Golos' secretary to arrange a meeting. They had talked a few times, but never recreationally. It was always to set up a meeting with Golos. Feklasov didn't like the sound of that. Julius told Feklasov that he had given Golos some identifying data for his Rosenberg network, meaning Jacob would have known the identity of Julius and a few of his agents. In this conversation, Feklasov was following proper KGB protocol. Before revealing the identity of the traitor, he wanted to discover how likely it was for Julius to be exposed. The more Feklasov heard about Julius's involvement with Golos, the more uncomfortable he became. At the time, Feklasov met with the Rosenbergs in December 1945. Soviet intelligence had already discovered the identity of the traitor through these means. Feklasov was here to inform the Rosenbergs who the traitor was and that they were compromised. Coming up, we'll reveal the devastation the hidden traitor caused to the Rosenberg network. Now back to the story. On December 15th, 1945, in the stuffy kitchen of the Rosenbergs' apartment, 27-year-old Julius Rosenberg was growing antsy from the grave look on Alexander Feklasov's face. He knew the traitor was close to his network of spies. Feklasov asked Julius if any information he exchanged with Jacob Golos might have been exchanged between Golos and his secretary. Julius told him that the information was only intended for Golos. Well, Golos shouldn't have shared it with her, but he couldn't guarantee that Golos had kept the information to himself. After a pause, Feklasov told Julius that Jacob Golos' secretary, Elizabeth Bentley, had betrayed the Soviet Union. She was currently in FBI custody and had already written 107 pages detailing Soviet spy operations. Her handler, Anatoly Gorsky, had been unable to intercept her before it was too late. Julius tried to remain calm. As Moscow Center was still assessing the damage of Elizabeth's actions, they agreed that contact between the Rosenbergs and Soviet intelligence should be suspended for 3.5 months. This was primarily to protect the other spies in Julius's life. If Elizabeth had mentioned Julius or Ethel, They didn't want the FBI to find more spies by following a Rosenberg paper trail. At the end of the meeting, Feklisov and Julius arranged to meet again on March 16, 1946, at 8 o'clock p.m. next to the Colony Theater, 79th Street and 2nd Avenue. In case Feklisov couldn't attend the meeting and had to send another agent, they also set up their recognition signal for their next meeting. As you may recall, a recognition signal is a simple phrase, word, or object that is used to identify yourself as an ally agent in public. For their next meeting, Julius was instructed to hold a copy of the magazine Post. Feklisov would hold a copy of Reader's Scope. He would approach Julius and ask him, "Are you waiting for Al?" Julius would respond with, "No, I am waiting for Helen." Feklisov would say, "I am Helene's brother. She asked me to tell you something." The official KGB transcript for this meeting had both pronunciations of Helen. Assuming this wasn't a mistake, it's likely these two spellings helped make the recognition signal as specific as possible. If either of the agents messed up this recognition signal, the meeting wouldn't happen. As you may have noticed, the signal for this meeting was also much more extensive than previous signals. This was a direct result of Elizabeth Bentley's sudden betrayal. Anyone who had made contact with Golos and Bentley received a similar treatment. It goes to show how connected Soviet spies were during the 1940s. One defected agent caused a major increase in security. At the end of the meeting, Feklisov also instructed Julius what to do if he was arrested by the FBI. He would deny that he was a member of the Fellow Countrymen, and he would deny his connections with Jacob Golos or Elizabeth Bentley. He would repudiate any photographs that showed him and Golos together, and he would burn all materials that could be used as evidence against fellow agents. As the head of the Rosenberg network and the hub of communication between all of his agents, this included many documents that Julius had spent years writing. Despite this loss of information, Julius agreed on all accounts and wished him good luck. Moments later, Feklisov was gone. For the next 3.5 months, Julius and Ethel remained in a state of constant worry. They knew Russia wouldn't be contacting them, but somehow knowing about the silence was worse. As they were ordered, they took the time to destroy all evidence connecting themselves to Golos. And they waited. Feklisov did make contact with Julius in March, but he didn't bring Julius the news that he wanted. According to Feklisov, Russia was still assessing the damage of Elizabeth's betrayal, but they would use Julius again as soon as they could. So life for the Rosenbergs continued as normal, at least as normal as it could while the threat of the FBI loomed ever larger over their heads. During this time, he continued to smuggle information out of the office with his Leica camera. He would sneak pictures of the documents while at work and then store film in his home, but it was more wishful thinking at this point. He was hoping he could give this information to Feklisov eventually, but Russia did not want to bring him back as an agent. The FBI could have been watching him too carefully, and they didn't want to risk another exposure. Throughout 1946 and 1947, Julius continued to receive messages from Feklisov, but it was always the same. The KGB was looking into using him again soon. At this time, another surprise entered the Rosenbergs' life. Ethel became pregnant with their second son. Robert Rosenberg was born on May 14, 1947. Despite the new child and the long hours at work, Julius remained as loyal to the Soviet cause as ever. He continued to maintain contact with his band of engineer spies and encouraged them to keep collecting information from their various government jobs. This period of Julius's life is perfectly summarized by a message Feklisov sent back to Soviet intelligence. He wrote, Despite the fact that Julius's connection with us has been interrupted for over 2 years, he continues to conscientiously and faithfully fulfill his obligations as a group handler, to stay in touch with agents, lending them vital moral and material support." End quote. But after almost 3 years of waiting, the standstill came to an end on August 19, 1949. On that normal summer day at the Semipalatinsk test site in northeast Kazakhstan, the Soviet Union conducted its first weapons test of the Soviet atomic bomb RDS-1, codename First Lightning. The control room buzzed with excitement. Soviet physicists Andrei Sakharov and Igor Kurchatov stood in the center of the room. They had been preparing for this moment for the last 10 years. Now was finally time to test their invention. Ever since Soviet intelligence had supplied them with the secret to the proximity fuse, they were full speed ahead. But this test came with its own danger. The moment the bomb went off, America would know. Their scientists would see the detonation in seismic readings. If they were going to let America know what they were doing, they needed to make sure it worked. All the engineers in the room looked to Andrei and Igor. It would be their call. With a quick nod, they proceeded. The Soviet scientists held their breath. It felt like an eternity. Did it work? They watched as a blast radius equivalent to 22 kilotons of TNT filled their screens. It spread out in a massive cloud, reaching over 3/4 the height of Mount Everest. According to the scientists present, it was 50% more effective than Soviet engineers had anticipated, even larger than the explosion the American bomb Fat Man produced when dropped on Japan in World War II. They were in the nuclear arms game now. The bomb's design was practically identical to the U.S. plutonium bomb Fat Man, as it also used a TNT hexagon implosion lens design. In fact, the fuse used to detonate the bomb was the same design that Julius had encouraged his brother-in-law to steal a few years before. Through their work, the Rosenberg Network had not only made this bomb possible, but they had hand-delivered one of the most elusive ingredients of the bomb to Soviet intelligence. As you may recall, the proximity fuse maximized the bomb's devastation by allowing it to explode in midair. This not only destroyed the target from above, but it also sent a massive airburst that devastated miles of land around the target's location. America quickly noticed. On September 3, 1949, U.S. scientists discovered unusual seismic activity inside the Soviet Union. This was an extreme burst, longer than an earthquake, and seen on seismic charts across the United States. Looking at their charts, it was unmistakably a nuclear bomb explosion. President Truman was immediately notified. Surprisingly, he refused to believe the news at first. He ordered the scientists to check the data again. At this point, the Soviet Union was not expected to have nuclear weapons for at least 10 more years. Americans, frankly, didn't believe Russia had the intelligence to make a weapon of mass destruction. U.S. scientists checked the facts again, but it was undeniable. America no longer had a monopoly on nuclear warheads. On September 23rd, over a month after the successful Soviet test, President Truman released a statement to the American people. Russia had nuclear weapons. At the same time, Truman ordered an investigation into the bomb. He was sure Russia had cheated somehow. The explosion was just too similar to an American bomb. Someone had let the secret out. Truman ordered none other than J. Edgar Hoover to oversee the case. Now, J. Edgar Hoover had already earned a name for himself as a manipulative and often brutal law enforcement officer. He was known for blackmailing celebrities such as Frank Sinatra and Jackie Kennedy, using details of their sexual indiscretions to force them to do his bidding. This atomic spy sting would be the perfect opportunity for Hoover to show off his power and patriotism. Meanwhile, back at the Rosenberg apartment on the Lower East Side, the Rosenbergs were ecstatic, whereas most Americans were terrified. The Soviets were winning. America couldn't hold the world hostage with nuclear power anymore. Now, another country had the same destructive force. Despite the Rosenbergs' joy, there was still some growing fear in the back of their minds. They were responsible for this great success. If the FBI connected their names with the bomb, they would certainly face life in prison. This fear came to fruition in January 1950, when American authorities received a message from British intelligence. That message informed the U.S. that a man named Emil Fuchs was outed as a Soviet agent. Emil had been working undercover as a Soviet agent in England. His goal was to monitor English atomic development. But his clandestine career was cut short when American intelligence decoded a Soviet message traveling from Emil to Russia in early 1950. The message confirmed that Fuchs was working as a spy for the Soviet Union. In January 1950, officers from Scotland Yard arrested Emil Fuchs and charged him with violating the Official Secrets Act. Within the month, Fuchs admitted to his role and was sentenced to 14 years in prison. Now, there's a reason his sentence was so short. Emil Fuchs was able to reduce his sentence by listing the names of other spies. This was a common practice for both American and British governments at the time, and they would find one spy and then offer to shorten their prison sentence if they agreed to report on other spies. The first name that Fuchs dropped was his own son, Klaus Fuchs. This is where the rabbit hole really began. What followed was a very rapid takedown of spies surrounding the Rosenbergs. On February 2nd, Klaus was arrested by British authorities. He too was threatened and given the chance to list more names to shorten his sentence. He took that chance. He told authorities that he had been allied with a man named Harry Gold. As you may recall, Harry Gold was the agent that Rosenbergs chose to sneak their atomic secrets out of the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. Harry Gold was sent to the lab to collect atomic secrets from Ethel Rosenberg's brother, David Greenglass. As we discussed last week, David worked in the manufacturing plant at the Los Alamos National Laboratory and had access to parts of the atomic bomb. In a quick exchange, David gave Harry atomic secrets. But Harry Gold's covert days were long over. On May 23, 1950, Harry Gold was arrested by American authorities. He, too, was given the choice to list spies to shorten his sentence. He gave them the name of Ethel's brother, David Greenglass. Within 3 weeks, on June 16, 1950, David Greenglass was seized by American authorities. He was held in custody and, like the rest, given a chance to list names. By now, the Rosenbergs were panicked. Not only had the FBI infiltrated their network, they had taken Ethel's brother. On the morning of June 16, 1950, Julius arrived home to find two FBI agents waiting outside his apartment. They curtly asked him to join them downtown. Julius was marched into the hollow office of the FBI. But believe it or not, the FBI had not detained Julius. In fact, they only brought him in to gain leverage over David Greenglass. They were hoping that Julius would help them learn more about David. Despite their expectations, Julius was the worst possible witness. Per his KGB training, he denied any involvement with his brother-in-law and refused time and time again to admit David was a Soviet spy. He ended the conversation by informing the FBI he would be getting a lawyer for any further conversations. With Julius, the FBI reached a wall. So they doubled down on David Greenglass once again. He proved difficult, but when the FBI threatened to arrest David's wife too, he finally broke. Trapped in the bureaucratic confines of the FBI, David Greenglass gave the Americans a name in exchange for his wife's freedom. Julius Rosenberg. Julius Rosenberg made him steal the atomic secrets. Julius Rosenberg was his Soviet contact. Julius Rosenberg was the top of a spy network in the Lower East Side. Coming up, we'll witness the unraveling of the Rosenbergs' lives. Now back to the story. July 17th, 1950. Ethel Rosenberg placed a warm brisket on the dining room table in front of her family. She felt lucky to have this home. Even if they were all listening to the Lone Ranger during dinner, she could share family time with Jay Silverheels. It was a happy moment. Julius was fiddling with his new Leica camera. Their sons, Michael and Robert, were already helping themselves to food. Ethel tried to shake the fear of American agents listening in on their perfect suburban life. But they were being careful. She and her husband regularly checked their apartment for bugs. Just then, Julius sat up from his chair. He was listening very carefully. Was it a transmission over the radio? Another message from Russia? Ethel couldn't hear anything. It was the middle of the day in the Lower East Side, but the normal bustle was fading. Ethel watched as Julius hurried to the window. The street looked normal, but it always seemed normal before they were here. There was no time to run. Half a dozen men in suits barreled into the room, guns raised. They pointed the firearms at the Rosenberg family. Julius called for the men to stop. At least he thought he did. It was all happening so fast. Ethel watched as the men ran Julius into a wall and grabbed fistfuls of his cheap cotton suit. Julius's thin rim glasses scattered in the struggle. Everything was a motion blur. The whole family was screaming. Julius was taken to FBI custody later that afternoon. They continued to question him, but once again he refused to cooperate. He denied any involvement with Soviet authorities. Following protocol, the FBI arrested Ethel Rosenberg on August 11, 1950, as a way to gain leverage over Julius. But Julius refused to break. They threatened him with a life in jail, but the Rosenbergs' nationalism couldn't be broken. Julius and Ethel remained in police custody for a year. On March 6, 1951, in Foley Square, New York, 11 men and one woman sat in courtroom 110, ready to lay judgment on the Rosenbergs. Julius and Ethel entered the room and sat down in front of the crowd. According to the witnesses gathered, they were somber and quiet, hardly speaking at all. The key witness in the trial was Ethel's brother, David Greenglass. He agreed to testify to save his wife. After his initial confession, the FBI continued to threaten David and his wife with jail time. In order to save his wife and himself, David told the crowd about Julius's network of spies. He said that Julius convinced him to steal the secrets and that Julius was a communist through and through. Initially, David Greenglass only said that Julius Rosenberg was a spy. In this way, he was only condemning his brother-in-law, not his sister. But Judge Irving R. Kaufman wasn't satisfied with only Julius's incrimination. He wanted to know about Ethel's involvement as well. David was conflicted. On one side, his wife, on the other, his sister. He was forced to choose between them. After being prodded about Ethel's involvement, he gave the following statement. In September 1945, when I was again on furlough in New York, I drew up a sketch of the atom bomb and prepared about 12 pages of written material. Julius said, "This is very good. We ought to have this typed up immediately." Ethel did the typing. By saying Ethel did the typing, David proved that Ethel was aware of Julius's life as a spy and the damage he was causing America. To those gathered, this was more than enough to prove that Ethel was guilty too. If this feels like a large jump in logic, you are not alone. Many activists believe that being aware of her husband's actions was not enough to incriminate Ethel Rosenberg as well. But we have to remember the time period here. With the Red Scare in full swing, people were looking for an excuse to punish the Soviet Union. The Rosenbergs had just become the poster child of that punishment. Knowing about espionage was just as dangerous as actually committing the crime. On April 4th, after a month of debate, the jury found both Ethel and Julius Rosenberg guilty. But the most startling moment of the trial was yet to come. Judge Kaufman gave the punishment. He said, "I consider your crime worse than murder. I believe your conduct in putting into the hands of the Russians the A-bomb years before our best scientists predicted Russia would perfect the bomb has already caused, in my opinion, the communist aggression in Korea, with the resultant casualties exceeding 50,000. And who knows but that millions more of innocent people may pay the price of your treason. By your betrayal, you undoubtedly have altered the course of history to the disadvantage of our country." Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were sentenced to death. The Rosenbergs' lawyer, Emanuel Bloch, spent the next 2 years trying to save the Rosenbergs from the electric chair. He cared for their sons, filed appeal after appeal, and even stood outside the White House gate begging to appeal to President Eisenhower. But it was all in vain. It was the words of President Eisenhower that ultimately settled the debate. He said, "The Rosenbergs may have condemned to death tens of millions of innocent people all over the world. The execution of two human beings is a grave matter, but even graver is the thought of the millions of dead whose deaths may be directly attributable to what these spies have done." On June 15, 1953, the Rosenbergs were denied their final chance for a review, and they were sent to the electric chair at Sing Sing Prison in New York. That evening, the Rosenbergs refused a final meeting with David Greenglass. At 8 p.m., they were marched to the chair. The reason this final meeting was denied is unclear, but most theorists assume the Rosenbergs didn't want to meet the man who incriminated them in court, even if he was related to them. In front of the electric chair, the Rosenbergs were given one last chance to speak in exchange for their lives. But Julius and Ethel denied this final plea. Julius's final words were to his lawyer, Emanuel Bloch. "Be strong for us, beloved friend, and we wish you a long life to continue your fruitful work in health and happiness. Never let them change the truth of our innocence." Ethel waited outside while Julius took the chair. He died instantly. After a few minutes, Ethel was brought to the same chair, and she was electrocuted. After the first burst, her heart was still beating, so she was shocked again. After the second burst, witnesses reported seeing a ghastly tomb of smoke over her head. And just like that, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were the first U.S. citizens to be put to death for the crime of espionage. Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday with a new episode. You can find more episodes of Espionage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Paul Liebeskind. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. Espionage is written by Michael Herman. I'm Carter Roy.